Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host Laura Chan Baker.
Hello.
Hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Every week, we come together in the International Space Station that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we're going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing the current state of the illustration industry, why desk jobs can be exhausting, and the inherent privilege of creative work. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our special guest and fellow Jackie Winter artist, Becky Orpin. Becky is a creative practitioner based right here in Melbourne. Her work occupies a space between illustration, design, and craft. Becky has run a freelance studio for over 20 years, catering to a wide range of clients, as well as exhibiting her work both locally and internationally. She has authored four DIY books and one children's title. Her work is described as colorful, graphic, bold, feminine, and dreamlike. She also happens to be the other half of Raf Rashid, who we interviewed way back in episode 33. So we're delighted to welcome you to the show. Becky, welcome.
Thank you.
We're completing the set. We're going to have to interview the kids next.
Yeah, do the kids. They'll be way better than either of us.
Yeah, we're very happy to have you here. One of our very favorite people in the room with
you
us.
Guys.
And congratulations. You had a recent book launch. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep. Last week.
Yeah.
What's This? Yeah, which was a kind of crazy thing where I didn't quite illustrate it. I kind of art directed and built all these sets and just designed the visuals instead of illustrating. So kind
amazing.
Of wild.
We'll get the plug in right up front.
Yes. Yeah. Go buy it.
Good work.
And Laura, you're a bit worse for wear today after kind of the annual pitch night celebrations.
Yeah, we went to RMIT last night to meet the cohort of graduating advertising students who are lovely and charming, and they can drink and we can't. We're old ladies.
Did you feel like you had to kind of like physically fight them? Like, you know, because you came from pitch night, we found you there. Like, is there some kind of like ritual that you have to do?
No. We were very much the big sister table. Like, I actually felt like we were part of a big sister program, because I think most of the students coming out of there are wanting to meet the big ad agencies, whereas we're really there more to give advice and, you know, to chat them through stuff. And it was very much a big sister program going on, but it was lovely. We met some very wonderful young people. We ate so many canapes, and I think all the champagne stock in the world is gone now.
And it fulfills one of my always long-held professional goals of having our logo on a wall, you know?
Yes, yeah. Which we did not get a photo in front of. I'm deeply sorry, Jerry.
What? What did we pay for?
No one was getting the photos in front of the photo wall, and we just felt we couldn't do it. We couldn't do it. But I did get a very bad boomerang where we missed Clara actually popping the champagne bottle, and I got a really nice photo of the cheese board. I think we're good on social content.
Surely you can Photoshop a JW logo onto there somewhere.
Glad to know our priorities are in order.
You sent the wrong person.
Well, do your best and take us through our first link, Laura.
I will. So I found this one on Lecture in Progress, which is a website. I actually didn't know this before. I didn't know that it was done as well by the founders of It's Nice That.
It's now under a whole kind of different holding company in a way at the moment. Are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of that. Tell me.
So they are the Hudson Beck Group. And so, yeah, It's Nice That and Lecture in Progress is one of their properties, and they have another studio called Anyway. So that's kind of like the actual kind of creative department there.
Right. Well, I didn't know any of this, but what I do know is that Lecture in Progress is basically their arm that sort of aims to empower emerging talent by providing sort of advice and insight into the creative industry and sort of sharing from their learnings in a free way. And this one in particular is an interview with the membership manager of the UK's Association of Illustrators, the AOI, who we reference a lot. And yes, their membership manager, Lou Bones. And in a manner that is very unlike me, and I promise has nothing to do with my hangover, I actually don't want to spend too much time talking about what I thought of the piece. That's kind of not the point today. What I really wanted to do is kind of go through some of its various sections and points and hear each of your thoughts, because, I mean, the main thrust of the article is really that illustration is booming. And obviously you've both had long and varied careers in illustration and different sides of it. And, you know, it opens with there's never been a better time to be an illustrator. And I think I know a lot of people who would both very much agree and disagree with that statement. Becky, I mean, when did you start working as a commercial artist?
Well, I started 21 years ago.
Yeah, so
It's been some time, but actually it's really interesting because I always wanted to be illustration but never saw it as a career. And I remember doing art at school and graphics, and we were really limited in that's all we could do, whereas I know now kids can do all various types of specialized creative things as topics. But my art teacher just never recognized me because I wasn't a fine artist and I wanted to do illustration. And I subsequently failed art because he never recognized. And so then it just kind of put me on this like crazy path of like not ever recognizing that illustration was a career.
It's like the record labels that like didn't pick up the Beatles. And now they look back and they're like, oh, what we've missed. Yes. But I mean, so you say you never looked at illustration as a career. Well, and I guess, so would you say that now that illustration is very much something that people present as a career, that's sort of a good sign?
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. I mean, Jeremy, you've been working in this space for a long time. I mean, Jackie Winter, you've run for, what, 11 years now? Have we just passed the 11-year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Crazy.
Crazy.
Do you agree with it? Do you think illustration, do you think it's the best time to be an illustrator right now?
I don't know. Something about that phrase is a bit kind of like, you know, feels a bit kind of salesy. It's like, there's never been a better time. And then I also kind of think about the span that we got all the time. It's at Infographics Were Ruling. Do you remember that? Were you in the office?
No, I don't know.
Yeah, there was a span that we, like, when Infographics Were Ruling, and me and Bianca would just kind of always go, like, hey, you know what's ruling?
Infographics.
So yeah, it feels a bit funny. I mean, there's kind of part of me that wants to say, yes, that is kind of true. And then part of me that says, like, well, if you kind of say that, is that kind of good for the industry? Like, is kind of more illustrators in the market a good or a bad thing? And that's kind of something that, I don't know, I kind of really struggle with, because I think part of me definitely kind of thinks, yes, it's good. The more, the merrier. Part of me also kind of feels like, well, yeah, flooding the market with this kind of supply.
Well, that makes each slice of the pie that bit smaller, doesn't it?
Exactly.
If you've got that many people.
And so does that mean it's never been a better time in that regard? And I kind of think we're going through a period, which is, I talk about kind of with photography, like when everyone got cameras and could become photographers, like that was problematic for the photography agency. But I think it actually in the end kind of acted as a big culling tool to kind of only leave the best in some ways, or kind of force people that were in kind of their emerging or mid-career phase to kind of come up with different ways to enhance their practice. So I don't think there's anything specific about this time that makes it a better time than last year or kind of 10 years ago. It's different, and there's a lot more kind of challenges, and I think there's a lot more kind of conversations. So a piece like this, I think, is really interesting in terms of all the points that they're bringing up. Nothing is kind of new to us or anyone who's kind of been working in the field for kind of a while there, but they raise some kind of important points that I think the thrust of this piece is more like, well, it's never been a better time to really educate yourself or to really kind of look at illustration as a formal practice, which I think is maybe that's alternative way to look at
it. Yeah. One thing that she mentions actually is the fact that, and that she mentions this in a sort of more positive light, but that designers are now becoming illustrators, and how things have opened up for people who've had a career in graphic design to sort of transition into illustration because the tools that they have allow them to do both. And Jeremy, I know that's something that you've talked about as well, and something that we've all sort of seen happen with people doing illustration in-house because they're like, oh, the designer can do it. And I guess I wanted to hear from you, like, do you think that that is a positive thing? Can it be a good thing? When is it a bad thing?
I mean, in terms of people having multidisciplinary skills?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just that lots of designers now, with sort of vector artwork being the trend, sort of now saying as well, calling themselves illustrators as well. This is what they sort of said, like all these people that were previously doing like strictly design are now sort of moving into illustration. And whether that is, do you think that's positive or do you think people should focus?
No, I think it's problematic. Where I'm seeing kind of people growing their work more is in specialization. And I kind of feel that there definitely was a period where people could afford to have lots of kind of bags of tricks. But I think as well, because of this huge influx in talented people, the only way to stand out is to kind of specialize in something. So I really kind of think as well, it's an individual, it's such a personal individual thing about where they kind of work and where you kind of want, what kind of environment you want to be in. And this isn't to say there isn't a place for generalists, and that's kind of not a good thing. Everyone you talk to is going to give you a much different perspective. So I'm giving an agent perspective, which is kind of what I think is, can give an individual the most benefit.
Yeah. For example, though, we talked to Elliot the other week, Elliot Burford, who's at Google Creative Labs, and they talked about how they prefer to work with generalists because they never really quite know the look that they're going for. So they want someone at those early stages who can really help them brainstorm that stuff. Becky, what do you think?
I kind of agree with Jeremy, but I didn't study illustration.
Yeah.
And I studied textile design, which is very drawing heavy. So
yes.
That's where, I guess, and I always knew my drawing skill was my strongest skill. But I totally agree with Jeremy in that, in my own 20 years, I've always said, I can be a graphic designer and I can do this, but it's only in the last 5 years when I'm like, actually, my graphic design is pretty shit. And my strongest skill is my illustration. And I feel like you can often, and I see a lot of interns come through my studio and often they're graphic designs and they're like, I'm going to be an illustrator. And I'm like, you actually probably shouldn't. Your skill is graphic design. And often, yes, there's definitely people will learn that they're good at illustration throughout their course. Mm. But I don't think you should come out thinking you can cover all bases.
Totally. That's something we saw a lot of last night at RMIT.
What you were saying about vector illustration, I think there's a trend against that.
Oh, yes, and very much so.
Yeah, and definitely in my own work, I've definitely seen I'm being hired to do things other than vector, which is more like making stuff, like paper illustrations.
Yeah, and I think that's the point, is highlighting the craft that goes into it.
Absolutely.
As a revolt, you know, sort of a rebound from that other stuff.
Oh, if you look at something like the MailChimp rebrand, especially that, you know, we were talking a lot about over the last 2 weeks, like, you know, moved completely in the opposite direction of all the vector illustration that every kind of tech company has kind of been doing. So, I think it's all these kind of things are always a reaction against kind of what is kind of trendy or kind of, you know, happening at the moment.
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing they talk a lot about in this piece is, as you mentioned before, sort of education and I guess financial and sort of negotiation literacy amongst this sort of growing class of illustrators. And I'm wondering, for people who don't have agents, obviously we do that sort of stuff for most of our artists, even if some of them have a lot of that literacy themselves, that's one of the main reasons we exist, is to help educate them and to help manage that portion of their career. But do you think that outside of that, with this enormous growth of illustrators and design illustrators, that there is enough financial literacy?
I don't. But I mean, I feel like the only education I've got for myself is from you guys, is from Jackie Winter and from you handling, you know, bigger accounts for me and actually understanding what my worth is. And I always have undervalued my worth. So I think it's really hard to find information. And it's something that people constantly contact me about to say, what do you think I should charge for this? And I still feel like I think it's really hard. And I did have a quick Google before I came in to see if I could find anything. And there's not really any industry standard, especially in Australia. I think that's quite hard.
This whole idea of the Lecture in Progress site as well is to fulfill this need for education that people want. And so I think because that's there, it's obvious that there isn't, that these things kind of aren't there. It's really hard. We've been having lots of internal discussions over here. It's like, yeah, well, how much of this can you actually kind of give away and how much can you put in the public before it, you know, compromises your IP or a lot of the time you can put kind of pricing and financial information out there, but it needs to be contextualized by other kind of services and ways of kind of going.
A blanket response doesn't suit. Pricing is such a tricky bespoke thing that needs to shift depending on all the different nuances of a situation.
But the bottom line is that there isn't enough literacy out there that comes to...
Yeah, because we learn to do it somehow, so other people could learn to do it.
But you're talking about something very subjective in terms of how you get to kind of the value of work. And I think one thing that I'm always kind of trying to do in the business is kind of take out the subjectivity and try to find where the objective markers are in financial success or failure. And that's kind of something where our heads really kind of at the moment. But I kind of think that this is another thing where it's like, well, it's never been a better time to be an illustrator. The more illustrators there are around, the more competition there is, the more that, you know, people question their own value because it's all the kind of power is with kind of clients because they can kind of choose between anyone, and therefore that erodes your own confidence in your own pricing, and then the pricing goes down, and then that affects your ability to kind of sustain your own practice in there. So it has a very kind of cyclical effect.
Because value has to have some element of scarcity to really exist, you know.
Keeping the fry pan hot.
Exactly. Supply and demand, blah, blah, blah.
Laura, what's your kind of perspective on this, like, you know, from an agent? Because I think, you know, mine's a bit different from a business owner. Becky's might be different from an artist. Like, are you somewhere in between here with anything?
No, I think I agree with pretty much everything you guys have said. I think, yeah, absolutely, that in the one sense, it's a fantastic time to, if you're interested in illustration, it is a fantastic time to be alive because, yes, it can actually be a career now. And there are lots of avenues to learn about illustration. And also, there's lots of ways to essentially self-represent through Instagram, through whatever, and to be able to get your work out there and communicate that. It's no longer such a crazy idea to be, you know, I'm going to grow up and be an illustrator one day. Mm. So in that sense of what they're saying, then absolutely, that's a phenomenal thing and it's a great time to be an illustrator. But yes, I think it's tricky because in terms of just what's happening in the industry, the number of illustrators, what's happening with budgets and the sort of flux of the, particularly when it comes to advertising and stuff, the flux of the industry right now is can actually make it a really, really, really tricky time to be an illustrator. I think the point you raised about photography is a really good comparison here, where we've got some of the best technology available and people are using photography for everything. That's wonderful. But those exact things have also really harmed the industry, and it's a lot harder to charge well as a photographer nowadays. So yeah, I think there's many facets to this, and I think the biggest takeaway is, as you were just saying, is that there is very little way to sort of learn more about this stuff, and hopefully we can help somewhere in the future.
Are there any other kind of points in the article that you want to flag at all that you felt were important?
Well, at one point they mentioned about sort of new arenas for illustrators and how the rise of sort of moving image in VR has seen a sort of shift in the kinds of content rather that clients are trying to create, and also, I guess, in the technologies that artists are exploring with their work. I wanted to know, Becky, I mean, you obviously, as you said, you started out with very like sort of traditional hand-drawn stuff, and then obviously you do a lot of digital work as well, and then you also do lots of big physical installation stuff. It's quite the mix. I mean, has the rise of sort of AR, VR, any other sort of technologies impacted your practice at all?
I mean, I don't do anything moving, but it's definitely something that I've always talked about learning, possibly for 10 years and still haven't done it. But I definitely find a lot of the jobs that I have are like, this is going to be animated.
Yes. Yeah.
So for me, from a point of view, to have that actually, that thought, and also when things are animated, you have to have a lot more story.
Yes.
The work that you have to produce has to have, you know,
absolutely,
go with the story, and that changes the way you approach a brief as well. So definitely, I think, yeah, it's changed. It's changing. But I mean, been working for a long time and there's always changes.
Yeah,
you either adapt or you don't adapt, and that's all there is to it, really.
Absolutely.
So you just got to take it all, I don't know, on the chin.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, I mean, Lou mentions in the thing, some of our illustrators are working almost entirely in VR now, which is kind of crazy to think that there are illustrators who are getting enough work, I don't know, to be working entirely in VR. I don't know.
I think this all goes back to the concept of specialization and just having more different modes of expression, more different canvases, the more opportunities there are to kind of stake your claim kind of in that area.
The shifts in these sorts of technologies impacted like the kind of artists that you're looking for or thinking about looking for in the future?
I still think it's very trend-based, and I think there's a huge trend at the moment like towards kind of art-based illustrators or, you know, having kind of an art-based kind of practice and that kind of intersection, which is something really interesting from the Australian perspective, because I think one thing that I always talk about of the Australian illustration landscape is that the reason I think that we had kind of, or maybe even still have kind of a lot of success with our artists is because there isn't that educational system that is kind of just self-reflecting itself stylistically, and your things are more kind of self-generative coming from other disciplines. And I think that makes the work feel really fresh. So I kind of feel though still, even Becky yourself, you know, you're working, you don't just work as an illustrator, you're a creative. You work across so many kind of different things, and you're an amazing model that I always kind of hold up for what a creative practice can kind of look like in terms of, you're not just doing one thing and staying static, and you're not just kind of an illustrator. You are kind of a creative or image maker, not you, but I mean, creatives in general can be much more multidisciplinary. So I think,
while still having a common thread between,
yeah, still
work
having
that
a
you
commercial
do,
yeah, sort of line in your work.
Yeah, yeah. So I kind of think, you know, there's something about illustration as a word or practice has been destigmatized, like in terms of feeling, I think illustration was, if you were an artist and kind of someone said your work was very illustrative, that would be seen in a pejorative sense, you know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, where now I think there is a bit more kind of legitimacy because of how it kind of has placed itself like within popular culture and within digital culture especially. So I think maybe it's time to kind of rephrase the article and be like, well, there's never been a better time to be an illustrator. Maybe it's kind of in my typical way being a bit more wordy here, but there's never been a better time to inject illustration into your career or bring illustration into your practice. I don't think there is such thing as an illustrator anymore, but I do think that there are illustrative kind of skills, or seeing the different places that you can bring that in and making sure that is kind of valued appropriately, I think is there's never been a better time for that.
Awesome. Thanks, Jeremy. I got what I needed.
Excellent. We'll leave it there and move on to the second link soon.
Cool.
Moving on to the second link of the week is my pick from the website Vox, a favorite of ours and mine. I don't think we featured it on the site before, and I'm dying. I forgot where I got it from. So if I got it from somewhere completely obvious and not crediting the initial spot, it must have been a newsletter, RSS feed or something. Anyway, the title of the piece is Why Your Desk Job Is So Damn Exhausting.
My answer is you, Jeremy.
Well, it might be, as we will find out. But this is something that really kind of spoke to me at the moment, because in case you haven't heard me kind of whinge, for the last kind of 3 months, I've had glandular fever from a lovely virus called cytomegalovirus, which is, yeah, you get it
sounds
from...
Sounds warm and fluffy and friendly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You get it from touching poo.
Hey! Stop touching poo, Jared.
Stop
touching poo.
Stop it.
And so it's made me just kind of really sensitive to my own kind of energy levels as well, because like I need to kind of, I'm trying to be careful, make sure like I don't kind of push myself too far, because I can get tired more easily, and usually kind of my energy levels and my everything is, you know, that's kind of something I've always took pride in. So I was a bit surprised that this kind of happened to me. And so when I kind of saw this jump out, it was like, it resonated with me because I have been very kind of tired at my desk lately. But the author Brian Resnick here proposes one of the most hotly contested issues in psychology: what causes mental fatigue and why is desk work so depleting? And so he goes over two hypotheses. One, we get so tired because we deplete an internal store of energy. And two, we get so tired because our motivation runs out. It's really, I mean, both these things kind of are really interesting. The first whole idea about an internal store of energy is interesting because, well, psychologists aren't kind of sure if it's real, because in, I guess, mental work or kind of desk work, there's no kind of real caloric expenditure as such. So they're wondering like, well, where does this come from? But I guess you could tie that back to something like the placebo effect, which is a very real thing that has physical manifestations, even though there might not be kind of a physical trigger. So I don't think there has to be kind of an exact correlation between, you know, those two things to make sense. But with the second example, he talks about when we get tired because when our motivation runs out. So as we work in a task, we struggle to focus on it or eventually lose interest. We become less motivated to do the task and drawn to the things that we kind of want to do. And so he references a really interesting study that was done with nurses and found that there's no correlation between the amount of physical work that the nurses did and their feelings of fatigue. So he says, in some people, physical activity is fatiguing. In some people, it's energizing, which I found kind of really interesting. And that really the nurse's subjective sense of how demanding their job was not correlated with fatigue either. So they were kind of saying that, well, boosting our motivation to stay on a task could lead us to feel less fatigued. And one study found that just paying people money when they're depleted can keep them on the task.
Yeah, let's try it.
But a similar thing is found in studies on physical endurance, that people can easily be pushed to work beyond what they think is their physical and sometimes mental limit. And so the question here at the end is, well, how can they best set up situations to make workers feel energized, motivated, and productive throughout the day? I think it raises some really interesting questions here, but I'm just kind of wondering before I go more to my own experience. Lara, which one of these two hypotheses resonate the most with you as kind of someone who is working, I guess, a desk job in some ways?
Yeah, for me, clearly, hypothesis number two rang truer. I think there are days where what I'm doing takes an enormous amount of mental capacity or even sometimes physical capacity, not that much in our job, but mental capacity for sure. And I'll come home feeling far less tired than certain days where I've had to do very little. I think for me, fatigue and boredom really go hand in hand. I'm like a child. This theory that, you know, as we lose motivation for whatever it is that we're doing, you know, we start to feel fatigued. That made a lot of sense to me, or at least it sort of lines up with my own experiences.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the first one, I think I actually resonated more with the first one. And
why is that?
I actually kind of think desk work can be really physical. And I kind of like, I notice as well, like, you know, when I'm talking, you know, I can kind of gesture or like,
you do like to wildly gesture.
Well, for me, like, I think when you talk about stress as well, like there is a kind of a bodily component. And I think there is an aspect to in a desk job that doesn't mean that your system isn't kind of being stressed, that you are that choosing between things, like even though, I mean, and that's kind of a funny thing, even though it's kind of creating mental fatigue, I can often see that manifest physically. You know, sometimes even like I notice kind of something when I get stressed, I really furrow my brow. That might take a percentage of a calorie, but it's still kind of expenditure kind of in that way.
And I think stress definitely has to tie in with fatigue. Like without a doubt, the more stressful days are the ones where I come home far more tired, without a doubt. And I think you're right. You're onto something that we're not doctors here, but I think it has to have something to do with the energy that it takes the body to deal with stress. You know, I think we can all agree stress equals bad, and that takes the body something to actually manage that.
The motivational side of things is interesting because I think that's kind of what I tap into the most, because like as a business owner kind of running the agency, I have kind of a very long-term view, and kind of every day is kind of me like chipping away at that. So I think whereas like I do have the experience of kind of working at a place where it was just kind of about like, well, what am I doing that day? Like that was kind of my focus. And as soon as I kind of hit a wall kind of there, whether the task was too hard or whatever kind of reason, then yeah, I would definitely kind of get much more.
Well, that's
fatigued.
The difference between working for your own business business and working for someone else's, you know, like you're chipping away your own vision versus chipping away at someone else's. I think those things.
But that's why, I mean, I do think there is kind of some merit there to that argument of motivation there. Becky, your practice is really interesting because you're in a bit of both worlds, which kind of, I can imagine, must be even more demanding. You know, on one hand, you know, there's this craft component of your work, which is much more physically active. And then there's the kind of more desk job where you're at a computer for days or hours on end. Which one of these kind of resonates with you, and what do you employ to keep your energy levels up?
I actually think hypothesis number two is good, because I definitely find I don't actually suffer from desk fatigue at all. So it's actually the opposite for me. So when I'm away from my desk and doing the physical things, that gives me the most energy. So I'm kind of like, beware when I'm sitting at my desk, then that's when, I wouldn't say I'm low energy, but there's days when I can, do you know what I mean? But the bit that's meant to drain my energy gives me energy. So the more physical side of it. But I definitely find if a lot of my projects are short term, and, you know, I just finished a long term job with you guys and I found that went for quite a few weeks. And my motivation for that was just so desperate, because I love the quick fix. And so I find that thing where it's like, yeah, if you're working on something for a long time, it's really, really hard. And that saps your energy. And I always wonder what it's like for like architects, where their short-term rewards are like monthly instead of like daily.
I think about this all the time.
And
about
I feel like
who work
when
on
I get
really huge infrastructure projects or something.
Yeah.
But that's a funny thing though. Sorry to interrupt, but like I've always found that when we work with architects, or when I have, it's always been some of the most stressful times. And I think some part of it is there's always that disconnect between like the architects are literally physically different, I think, in some ways, where they can have that tolerance for things taking a bit longer. And like I always tell people, my sense of time is actually warped from this job. Like because of the demands of our clients.
Everyone in advertising has a warped sense of time. I've also always been told never to date an architect, and maybe that's because they're warped. But an architect or an engineer, stay away. That's what I've been told.
Do you guys ever just like kind of come home? Like sometimes I get home at the end of the day and like my body is like buzzing from exhaustion because it's adrenaline as well.
It is adrenaline. I definitely feel that, especially if you're working on this hardcore deadline, then that adrenaline is addictive. But I really like it. And I don't find it fatiguing. I know it's a really bad
habit. I get that if it's something I've been enjoying doing. But if it's something I haven't been enjoying doing, then I just get that general tiredness. But I have often like that thing where you just can't shut your mind off. Like I find it particularly when I'm doing prep for the podcast, because we get to talk about really interesting topic things that genuinely interest me and do this research, which is something I really enjoy doing. But if I am doing it, I happen to be doing it, you know, late on a Monday night before we record on a Tuesday morning, I get into bed, and as much as I'm physically wrecked, my brain is like still thinking about all that. It's really, really hard to shut that off.
I think definitely for me, Jeremy, you were saying, what do you do to like, I think the breaks and the exercise kind of part is what gives me, if I'm in front of my computer for 10 hours, which I am like physically, like my body is fucked. Like my neck is fucked, like everything. So you have to get up and take those breaks. And when you do, it's like a revelation, you know.
Physios have made so much money off me since I started working desk jobs.
Right.
Seriously. Like I'm going to start invoicing you for my physio bills, Jeremy.
What's my favorite thing about the new Apple Watch? Not the new Apple Watch, but the Apple Watch kind of in general, and kind of activity monitors that do kind of prompt you to kind of
tell me what it's like to own one, Jeremy. Yes. He knows how badly I want one. I think you're just rubbing it in my face right now.
Is it the dangling of it in front of your face, like while you're working, that gives that away?
We do have a treadmill desk, so you could actually just dangle it while I run.
But getting on that treadmill desk has been, I've been doing that just a bit more as well to try to kind of.
That's a good energy thing.
Yeah, like it does help. I think a lot of it is kind of psychological. I think if you're someone who thinks that you fatigue easily or kind of get tired easily.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that.
You will get, it's like so much of it is kind of a mental thing. But I think the one thing from this article that, I was surprised it didn't include was the sheer physical nature of adrenaline and how that does fuel a lot of creative work.
But to me, that's quite different. Mental fatigue is completely different to physical fatigue. And often I'll feel mentally fatigued, but very rarely will I feel physically fatigued.
That's interesting. What do you think? What's the difference?
Well, mental fatigue is literally is my brain, and I can still like have mental fatigue. Well, I go to like PT at 5:30 in the morning. Definitely mentally, you know, not even awake. I often get there and I'm like, you have to wake me up right now because I can't.
I have the same thing.
But
every
I still,
day.
Body, but I still, yeah, my body my is still is able to act, whereas completely. My brain isn't able to act. So I feel like mental fatigue. Like I can get home some days and can barely string a sentence together, but I could still go for a run, or do you know what I mean? Like do those things. So to me, those things are really, really separate.
I totally agree. I have other times though where like I lie down, like my whole body feels just like a big lump that just like, ugh, just fall into the couch. But my brain's still just like, you know, I can hold a conversation and I can, you know, or I'll watch something on TV that takes, you know, some effort to watch and I'm, you know, I'm into it and I'm engaged, but my body is like, if I have to move at all, I will die.
I agree.
That's so interesting. Well, yeah, these are two really interesting perspectives. I'd love to hear any other tips that you might have out there. Which hypothesis do you believe? How do you keep your energy up? Send us a note at podcast@jackiewinter.com and we'll move to our final link soon. Moving on to our final link of the week. Becky, very excited to have you because you actually helped launch the first Open Tabs that we did at MPavilion all last year. There's a totally new MPavilion happening now. Yeah. I don't know if we're doing an Open Tabs at the new one, but
the plan is that we are.
The plan is that we are. So check opentabs.rodeo for that. What I'd like to do for everyone presenting a tab, find out a bit more about your internet reading habits. Where do you kind of find links and tell us about this one and why you chose it?
This is an article by a local writer, Rebecca Varco, on Junkie, which I think I actually found. It's like 2 years old, this article, so I think I found it on Facebook, but it's something I send to people quite often. I really like this article, which is about white privilege in the arts, basically, and are you at an advantage coming from a white middle class or upper class background, and is it harder to exist in this career path if you don't have those things? And so she writes about her own personal experiences. She's a writer but also studied fine art. Her parents are white and but she's still not necessarily incredibly wealthy, but she still considers herself very privileged. And she talks about her, I guess, you know, development through high school and through a few degrees and then graduating and various jobs and the people that surrounded her in those jobs and the privilege that she saw. And I think it's a really, really interesting thing to talk about because I never thought about that with myself. You know, even though I felt like I had this quite alternative upbringing, yes, it was still very white and it was still quite middle class, even though it was like in a commune and it was like all these kind of crazy things. So it's never something that I thought about until I read this article, really. And yeah, I think it is a definitely you're an advantage, well, for many things, but particularly this career that I'm able to have. And I think for one, my parents were able to support me in the beginning when I didn't have a lot of work. I still had 4 part-time jobs, but then if I could never make my rent, my parents were able to do that. I also had parents, friends who were able to buy my artwork or, you know, things like that, support me in other ways, or had friends who could afford to buy my artwork. So I think without those kind of things, perhaps I wouldn't have gotten where I'm up to now, you know. So I don't know. I just wanted to, you guys have both experienced in various creative realms. Like, what do you think about this?
It's a really interesting piece. I think it's a really challenging topic that she's chosen to tackle. And I think it's quite a...
No, I mean, it's a very confronting piece in terms of it's very raw.
It's very raw. And I think it's a brave choice to write it because no matter how she approached it, there were always going to be some issues with it. And she sort of acknowledges that.
She does. And that's why I think I really like it.
Yeah. It's just that's the nature of the topic, the way no matter how she writes about it,
she's going to be white privilege.
She's going to be white privilege. And it's going to be a weird thing where it's like it's good to be bringing that topic up, but also do you deserve to be? It's like there's so many questions and issues about it. And I think it's interesting because we've had here, the 3 of us, very different upbringings, very, very different, but I still all, as far as I can see, quite privileged upbringings. And I think the thing that this opened for me was really as well thinking about, I guess, that not everyone, this is a really, like, it's hard to talk about this stuff, you know, in a way that you want to be really careful with your words. Yep. But I think for many people, people are privileged and disadvantaged in multiple ways and in different ways. And there are certain people who have been almost entirely privileged. And then there's people, for example, like Rebecca, who had some difficulties, whether it was sort of the amount of money that her family had or being female or whatever else, and then other enormous privileges. And those things aren't necessarily always visible, or nor are they sort of able to be compared, but you know, because so you can't really line people up and go, okay, who's more privileged and who's more disadvantaged, and kind of weigh them up against each other. So it's a really tricky, area.
If you think
of
about your, like, so I started to think about my peers, who are all pretty much in a similar socioeconomic situation to me, and perhaps that's not just because I'm creative. Perhaps that's a whole lot of things. And the more I kind of thought about it, like the creatives I could pinpoint, you know, there's a lot of, on the whole, were white and middle class. And that I just thought that was interesting.
One thing I did the same thing thinking about my peers, both within a workspace sort of, but also my friendship groups sort of outside of here and past coworkers and things. And one thing that I hadn't really thought about was that we often talk or joke about how like I'm not much of a risk taker. I'm a very like careful, calculated person. And one thing that occurred to me like a few years ago was seeing some of my friends who, and this is not a bad thing, but as you were saying, if they got in trouble, if they couldn't pay their rent or if they crashed their car, or whatever, their parents were able to help pay for that stuff. And that's not a position I've ever been in. And I think those sorts of things really affect the choices that you make, because if you can afford to take certain risks or you can't, and again, I am incredibly privileged, but things like that, I sort of, I noticed there was something that a friend did, or, and I remember thinking to myself, like, I would never have fucked with that, because like, there's no way, it's not an option to, you know, because you have to pay for those things yourself or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I think what, she, you know, she raises the point over and over again, that if you haven't been in that situation, your brain isn't wired to think about what it's like if you aren't. And so like I'll see certain things like that, but then I'm sure there's a million other things that I will never see or understand. And that's so tricky.
Oh, look, Emmy, it's such a big topic. And
it
it's
is
a
probably
very,
too big.
Well, the reason that
we're
I like
solve
this,
it today.
I mean, yes, it's a real big meaty topic. I think it's something that we have kind of maybe shied away from to kind of talking about directly. And the timing for this is good as well. Because if you look at something like that's been in, well, at least my consciousness for the last few weeks of the whole kind of Kavanaugh hearing, which is all kind of a, I guess, a memorandum on kind of privilege as well, kind of in that way. And this whole idea of one of these kind of chasms in kind of our public life is this conversation about like, everyone just kind of got there by hard work and people kind of value kind of work over everything. But there is this thing called privilege and actually is part of it. And I think the thing that's interesting, or the thing that I like about this article, is just the fact that, or any kind of article about this subject, is that it's bringing it up and putting it in people's brains.
That's right.
Because I think the biggest part about this is that for everyone who kind of writes their kind of story or kind of brings this issue up, it expands your own kind of personal understanding of where you are contextually in society, which I think when you look at kind of our politicians as well, there's that tone deafness that thinks that they're only kind of in this kind of one area. And by opening your brain and being a bit more curious about other people's kind of experiences, I think that helps kind of put you in your place in a way. I kind of think, though, because it's such a big topic, the fact that this is more focused on how it manifests in the arts is where I think is something that we can kind of, I guess, interface with a bit more directly. And it's also interesting to come off the back of a conversation we had either last week or 2 weeks ago about Australia being a very kind of, or kind of how the arts, the funding model for Australia and arts fosters mediocrity in this kind of way. And I always kind of struggle with articles like this that are very kind of, I guess, more personal, because I'm a very, especially with
a
this
robot?
Podcast, I am a robot, but,
see,
but
I'm the opposite. Yeah, I want the personal.
I want the, for me, it's, I always am in problem solving mode at work, you know, and this is, this podcast is like a part of our work. And so like, I'm reading, I'm like, what's the problem? What's the kind of solution? And it's so hard to kind of get that from these pieces that are just exist to kind of explore.
But I think that's the point. There isn't a clear problem solution
and
for this sort of stuff.
The reason I really related to this article is because it got me thinking about it, because I was like, I can absolutely, and because she's in, based in, you know, she talks about places that we know and things that we know. And so that's when I was like, oh my God, I am this white privileged person, and what can be done about it? Or you
I
know.
Think something worth mentioning is that the reason she wrote the piece, it was spurred by a tweet. She said, last week, someone who I respect, a writer and editor who runs a literary journal I enjoy and have written for, tweeted about jobs. And they said, if you work a job that you don't enjoy / work for a company or organization whose output or services you don't agree with, this is your fault. And he said, yes, the entire system of economics and life and et cetera is fucked, and there are a billion mitigating circumstances, but still, do better. It's very difficult and perhaps impossible for short periods of time to ensure your work is true to you, but ultimately you are responsible. And he drew a lot of criticism for that.
Well, I think the reason being is because like it exhibits the same kind of tone deafness that you see in kind of all these old middle class politicians that in the arts community, like we're not immune to this way of thinking.
And it's often the way people look at people with, I don't know, with drug addictions or with alcohol problems.
Or homeless
people. Yeah, exactly. Like this is your choice. This is your, you know, and it's that failure to sort of understand the context and the situations that put people or lead people to certain
circumstances. And the cycle that just keeps going to keep them in that situation.
Well, Becky, you committed Lara's cardinal sin here, which is including a second link in your
I'm sorry.
No, which is
I just like to do the bare minimum, guys.
But this is a piece that was from It's Nice That, written by Gemma Germains, who is the founder of Well Made Studio. She writes a kind of, I guess, a shorter piece kind of covering kind of similar issues. But the thing that I kind of liked about it as well is she kind of offers a bit of a jumping off point of kind of some more direct action.
And I knew you'd like this.
So she says, I'll just kind of quote her at the end here, "To own our privilege is to begin addressing where and how we sow our seeds. We need to look further than that which is familiar if we're to tackle diversity. From how opportunities are shared to who we build relationships with, it takes a concerted effort to tackle the side effects of denying privilege. And I think that's pretty real. And I kind of think
it's the next few sentences, though, that are the best, Jeremy. She says, advertising jobs in the same place, speaking at the same schools, expecting the same path to generate new responses will only make things worse in the long run. And then she says, which I loved, next time you're advertising a new position, reach out to LGBT, BME and disability arts groups and use their networks to amplify not only the available role, but your stance on diversity. Actively support these groups with your time and money. And I think that's a really, really valid point.
Absolutely. These are all really good points. And there's one thing that I've kind of found really interesting as well. I've actually noticed that more junior people at creative companies are making the bigger decision, creative decisions. You know, it's like, I think you have your ECDs who are kind of at the helm, kind of trying to kind of give some direction, but especially a lot of like bigger brand work is trying to reach kind of younger people. And I think they are kind of giving a lot more responsibility because to younger people, because they're making more genuine and engaging work. And so I think just because you are in a junior position doesn't mean you actually can't exert influence. So I think articles like this kind of not only kind of help outline the path forward, but I think we should also kind of say that it is kind of possible, and this is kind of what you can do. It doesn't have to just be someone like myself kind of figuring out like, okay, this is how we're going to kind of outreach actively for our hiring, or if we're doing kind of a conference, this is how we're going to tackle diversity and inclusion. But yeah, like I think that it is a much more democratic thing that is accessible to people of all positions at the moment. So just before we wrap up, I guess I just wanted to ask one last question, Becky. I mean, do you think a creative career choice is more to do with personal intuition and talent, and that you can achieve anything with hard work no matter what your background? Or, yeah, I mean, from a personal perspective, you've outlined, you know, your own situation. But yeah, where do you think kind of, you know, things fall along that spectrum?
I definitely think it helps to be from a privileged background to get into a creative career. I was thinking what you said about before, Lara, when you were talking about your friends who would make decisions. And I was thinking that about my husband. My husband's not white and not from a middle-class background, and he makes choices completely differently, but he has worked really hard to get where but he's a very driven, incredibly motivated person, and has had to fight quite hard to get where he's got. But I do definitely think it helps. I hope that the situation is changing. I really hope that it's changing and that people have more awareness of not just employers, but actually it's also, you know, perhaps those career choices aren't offered to high schools in like lower socioeconomic areas as a viable option, or that parents don't support that. So I hope that people are able to go forth and support someone who wants to be creative, and that it can be a proper career. And
absolutely. Well, look, Becky, thank you very much for bringing in this link. Lots to kind of think about here and lots to chew over. We will put all of these articles in our show notes as we do every week, and hope to continue this conversation definitely well into the future on this very important topic. It is time for, drum roll, please, the brilliantly named thumbs up / thumbs down / shaka. The time we dedicate each week to get the good, the bad, the completely petty off our chest. Lara, get us started. What do you got? Thumbs up, thumbs down, or shaka?
You know what? It could be equal parts thumbs up and shaka, because I've got a thumbs up that stays in the family. My thumbs up is for Raph's eggplant palm.
Oh, yeah.
Fuck. So I went to his new beatbox. We all went, actually, for like a Friday lunch, all of us out in the office. And it was like this beautiful sunny day, first proper sunny day of like the season. And we sat outside and it was really nice to see Raph and stuff. But then we, and I know, like, I love the burgers, always had the burgers. They're great. And I shared half a cheeseburger and half an eggplant palm with Clara, because we were like, oh, good. Try both. Yeah. We can decide. And it's not like me to pick necessarily the meat-free option as the best. It was so fucking good. That's jalapeno pesto.
Yeah, that's the best.
Oh my God. My mouth is literally filling up with drool. Like I'm drooling.
Oh, it is lunchtime.
And
I might order one. Oh, that's such a good idea. Okay, great work, guys. I'm super, super keen. But yeah, fuck, that thing is delicious. If you're in Melbourne, get down and eat the eggplant palm, because it's life-changing. Becky, what about you? Have you got a thumbs up, thumbs down, shaka?
I reckon it's for your thumbs up. I don't know, just a bit of a time waster. More than anything else, Pantone has an IQ test, a colour IQ test on their website.
Oh, it seems like the perfect activity for today.
It's very quick and very easy, but I felt like I would not do well in an IQ test, but I got the best score in this IQ test.
You can join the Pantone Mensa.
I'm giving it a big thumbs up. Yeah.
Awesome. We'll go do it later and we'll share the link to that.
Yep.
Jeremy, what about you?
I have a thumbs up or a whole thumbs up. The sunny weather. Mine is for a book called Who is Michael Ovitz?
Who is Michael Ovitz?
Michael Ovitz is an American businessman, investor, and philanthropist, and he co-founded the Creative Artists Agency in 1975. And I found about him through another podcast on Debbie Millman's Design Matters.
Nice.
And often, like with these interview podcasts, I'm often like, well, I will only listen to the people that I kind of know. But for some reason, I decided to listen to this and I was so fascinated with his story about how he set up kind of CAA and the parallels there are to kind of, you know, obviously they're completely different and behemoth organization, you know, representing kind of the best, mostly actors, directors, et cetera, in Hollywood, and the parallels to kind of what we do as well. But he's someone who kind of was really deliberately behind the scenes for kind of a while, and he just wrote a memoir that came out in 2018. So I immediately got it on Audible and I've just been devouring it. I haven't finished it. It's such a fascinating story, but I think, you know, that's something we do with the podcast here as well. Like a lot of the guests that we have on, sometimes people might not have kind of known, you know, because their names aren't kind of household design names, but they're some of the best conversations we've had. So my thumbs up is both to the book, Who is Michael Ovitz, as well as kind of just listening to interview podcasts of people who you might not know because you might get something amazing out of it. And that's pretty much all I got for this week. Becky, if people want to find out more about you, apart from, of course, your Jackie Winterfolio, where can they do that? What are the socials?
Instagram is probably the best social, just at my name, BECIORPIN.
And they can follow the adventures of your newest addition as well.
Oh my God. That's my other big thumbs up is my new kitten.
Yes.
Big thumbs up for that.
Yes. Yep. He's so little. Yep.
What's the name? Is there a name
Chippy?
Yet?
Chippy. We let our 11-year-old name it.
Chippy. Yep. Hey, he didn't do too bad.
No, Chippy. Well, it's got various Chippy, Chi-Chi, Chipotle.
Into it. Oh, my Chip. Dad calls me Chipotle. Yeah.
Oh, good. Oh, that's good vibes.
Named your cat after me. I like it.
Laura, before we wrap, it's time to do our speed run.
It's time to do the least useful thing for listeners that we've ever done.
But the most fun for me.
The most fun for Jeremy, and he's the boss man. So the time to beat is 49 seconds and 95 milliseconds.
Look, it's not going to happen, but let's try it anyway.
Today, yeah, might not be the day. But you know what? We're posy. We're going to go for it. I'm getting my timer up. All right, Jeremy, you ready for this?
Yep.
Okay. Done your mouth exercises? Beautiful. All right. 3, 2, 1.
I'm Jeremy Wartz and she's Laura Tenbacon. This has been Jackie Winter Gives the Business. Our theme music by Totally Unrelated, our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out the stuff on soundcloud.com/JackieWinter. If you want more Jackie Winter Gives the Business, archives of all the shows and links can be covered at Jackie Winter. If you want more of Jackie Winter Gives the Business, archives of all the shows and links we cover can be found at Jackie Winter. That gives you that a bit. To receive all the links we talk about the show each week in one neat little package, you can sign to our podcast newsletter at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter, with Jackie with the Y Winter Likes to See. You can hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@JackieWinter.com. If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing, rating, and leaving us a comment on iTunes, and of course, recommending us to all your mates as well as they can get the show wherever you get podcasts, including Spotify and Stitcher, or for the truthers directly from our website, Jackie Winter gives you the up is. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this podcast, Overcast, or Cash, you'll be able to see links to the articles we're talking about them, as well as other schmick visual content that rabbit on. It's like we're right there in the room with you. And if you work for an advertising agency, design studio, and you're interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.radio for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye.
Holy shit, he did it. He did it. Jeremy, you're going to have to keep doing this every week.
What did I get?
Fuck. 48 seconds, 79 milliseconds.
Even with that stumble?
Amazing. Even with the stumble.
I could feel it. It was like watching a bike race where
Jeremy, the words no longer have any kind of enunciation.
They have no meaning. I'm just kind of in complete flow mode.
For anyone who actually wants any information, all you need, it's jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz or hit us up at podcast@jackiewinter.com.
Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week. Bye. Bye. Becky has run a freelance studio for over 20 years. Becky has run... Fuck off! Stop it. You're making it harder.
Okay, we'll shut up.